No, Russ is somebody. I really don't think that I have to introduce Russ Anderson, but I'm going to do it anyhow a little bit. He's one of the leading security experts and those security engineering experts. And he's going to tell us something that we've always known and never wanted to know, is that you cannot anonymize personal data. And if you do, you probably can de-anonymize it again. And how this is done and why you shouldn't walk around. I know, you know, you get told all over, yeah, we're going to anonymize your data and everything's okay. Just don't believe them. Believe Russ. Here we go. Russ, it's your mic.
Great, thanks. So this talk is on inference control. If we can move on to slide two. Here I think... lovely quote from Cory Doctorow. Anonymized data is one of those holy grails like healthy ice cream or selectively breakable crypto. Slide three, please. This talk is basically a synopsis of the 11th chapter of my security engineering textbook, the third edition of which will be out next month. And in fact, I've put all the chapters online for review and feedback. And they will be on my website until the end of this month. That is until the weekend. So if you want to download them for free, go to my website and get moving. Next slide, slide four. What I basically cover in the book chapter is 40 years of inference control. And inference control has come in four waves: early work on statistical disclosure control by Dorothy Denning, Tori Delinius, etc. Then in the 90s, applications like medical records where the data are richer than with census, and policy people start being in denial, saying that yes, anonymization works, when they'd already been told in the 80s that it didn't. Then in the 2000s, we start getting internet scale because search engines can identify people in large data sets such as movie preferences, and policy people are still in denial. But we have one significant development there, differential privacy. And then the fourth wave in the 2010s is when we all move to phones and we have social media, location histories, and on the scientific end, we've got genomics. And these are all widening the gap between policy and reality. And this has got a whole lot of implications from GDPR through operational security to ethics. Next slide, slide five. Sure. Now, statistical disclosure control starts round about the year 1980, about 40 years ago with the US Census. And until then, only totals and samples had been published, such as population and income per ward, plus one record out of 1,000 which had identifiers removed manually, and these were available as a population sample in more detail. Now, in 1980, the US Census decided to move to an online database system, and this completely changed the game. And the census administrators planned to anonymize the data, and Dorothy Denning, who was working there, bet her boss that she could work out his salary from the data that the census was proposing to publish. He said, no, you couldn't possibly do that, but she did it, and she won the bet. And she's since had a very eminent career in information security. Next slide, slide six. So how can you go about trying to control statistical disclosure? Well, a naive approach is to control the query set size. So for example, in New Zealand, if you make a query of the medical records database, then this will only be answered if it's answered from at least six records. And this is what the US Census was trying 40 years ago. And one problem there is tracker attacks. So thinking back to the year 2000, when I first wrote the first edition of my book, then at the computer lab, we had one female professor and six male professors. And professorial salaries are confidential because, you know, some people get bonuses. But if you wanted to work out the salary of our female professor, Karen Spark-Jones, you could have tried, what's the average salary of all professors, all seven of them, and the average salary of all male professors, that is all six of them. And then it's easy to work out Karen's salary, or even use the same figures for all non-professors. Now, what was shown by Dorothy Denning and colleagues back in about 1980 is that on realistic assumptions, trackers exist for almost all sensitive statistics. Next slide, slide 7, please. Torre Delinius also got involved in this, and he pointed out that you have to do an awful lot of cell suppression if you have got multidimensional data. Here is an example that could be in a university. If each student studies one major subject and one minor subject in science, and you've got a rule saying that you have to publish statistics of marks, but that no student should learn any other student's mark, then you can see from this table that the students who study geology with chemistry are only two in number. And so if you published an average mark for geology plus chemistry, then one of these students would be able to work out the other student's mark. So next slide, please, slide 8. And therefore you blank out the number 2, geology plus chemistry. But that's not enough, because that can be reconstructed from the other rows or columns. So you have to blank out another item in each row and in each column of the cell that you originally suppressed. And this means that if you have got n-dimensional data, whenever you suppress a cell, you expect to have to suppress in total 2^n cells. And this rapidly makes your data useless. Next slide, slide 9. So can you keep track of this? Well, another approach is query auditing, where you keep track of all the questions that have been asked. And as soon as enough questions have been asked on the database for private information to be reconstructed, you answer no more questions. Well, this doesn't really work, because firstly, it's a difficult problem. It's NP complete. Second, it uses up your privacy budget. And third, users may collude. So you can't just give each user a privacy budget of making as many queries as they can before they leak data, because two or more users can work together. Other techniques you can use include trimming to remove outliers. So back in the mid-1990s, when I first got engaged in this problem with medical records, there was only one patient in the whole of Chichester who was HIV positive. So then what we did was to see to it that rare conditions, as HIV was then, were reported nationally rather than locally. Random sampling is another approach. Rather than answering each query with respect to all the records, you just get a subset of records, which you maybe choose by hacking the query with a secret key to make it repeatable. Another thing that you can do is to swap records. In the US census up until last time, and in the UK census, in recent censuses, the algorithm is to exchange some records. So if you have a family with 2 adults and 2 children in Cambridge, you might swap them for a family with a similar sized house in Bedfordshire, for example. And this means that you don't disturb the statistics very much, but you make the live records unreliable from the point of view of anybody who's trying to, for example, tell stories or use them as evidence. This isn't very good, because typically only a minority of records are swapped. And if you only swap 10% of records, then the live records are still true 90% of the time. Another thing you can do is perturbation. You can add random noise, and we'll have more to say on that later. So that was the state of play in the 1980s. And at the end of it, we come to the conclusion that statistical disclosure control is really, really hard. And unless you have got a well-defined problem where you know in advance what the queries are, it's going to be difficult. But then in the mid-1990s, there's suddenly a rush to create databases for secondary use of medical data. Now, up until then, a medical researcher wanting to investigate a disease would go into a hospital's library and then sit down with many paper records and spend weeks collecting data. But as hospitals computerized, people wanted to use the computerized medical record for cost control, clinical audit, research, and so on. And there are different approaches. Germany didn't allow central collection, but then after East and West Germany came together in 1989, they found that East Germany had brilliant cancer records, but these were used for research in ways that were illegal in the West. And so they had to rush to figure out how to make cancer registries anonymous. The options available, well, in Denmark and New Zealand, you had lightly scrubbed data kept centrally with strict usage control. So names and addresses weren't there, but everything else was. And that's the route that Germany eventually followed for cancer registries. In the USA, you had lightly scrubbed data for controlled uses, but slightly better scrubbed data for open uses. In 1996, Latanya Sweeney, then a research student, showed that she could re-identify the medical record of William Weld, the governor of Massachusetts, from the public data that was made available by the Veterans Administration. And in the UK, we had summary data with postcode and date of birth. And this caused tussles from the late 1990s because people who tried to opt out were ignored. So what are the limits of medical anonymization? Well, suppose you want to find out about former Prime Minister Tony Blair. So you Google him and you find that he was treated for an irregular heartbeat in Hammersmith Hospital on two specific dates while he was in office. And so if you've got a database which links up successive hospital episodes, then you've got him. You just look for the one encrypted patient ID which appears in both of these hospitals on those two dates. Then you've got Tony Blair. Then you look at all other instances of that encrypted patient ID and you've got his complete record. Now, if the database doesn't link up successive records of care, then you can't do serious research with it. And since then, it's got worse, because when you add demographic and family data, then re-identification becomes still easier. If you get active attacks, where you can observe a database before and after a particular record is added, it becomes still more difficult. And then you add social network stuff, such as friends, disease, contacts, and nowadays, of course, genomics, and privacy becomes a still more intractable problem. And so the only way to stay ethical is either to get patients' consent, which means at the very least an opt-out, or else have some legal provision that in some circumstances, such as a pandemic, the government is, for overriding public interest reasons, entitled to some data. Next slide, slide 12. The European case law on this is clear. It's based on the European Convention on Human Rights, Right to Privacy, clarified in a case called IV Finland. And this started back in the early 2000s when Ms. I was a nurse in Helsinki who was HIV positive, and her hospital systems let all clinicians, that is all doctors and nurses, see all patient records. So her colleagues noticed her status and hounded her out of her job. Now, the Finnish courts refused her compensation, but Strasbourg overruled them in 2010. And what this means is that everyone in Europe, everyone within the Council of Europe treaty states, has got the right to restrict our personal health information to the clinicians who are caring for us. And this means that you must give people the right to opt out. There was a big scandal in Britain because our former Prime Minister David Cameron brought in a policy in January 2011, sorry, this is next slide, slide 11, saying that anonymized data should be made available to researchers, both academic and commercial, but with an opt-out. Now, the opt-outs had the wrong defaults. They were a bit like Facebook. They were difficult to access and they had obscure mechanisms and they got changed whenever too many people learned to use them. And this was designed, like Facebook's, to see to it that most people didn't use privacy mechanisms that got in the way of business. And then in 2014, we found that these hospital data had been sold to 1,200 different buyers, universities, firms, and others. And these were all over the world. Europe, America, China, lots of companies that were completely outside the scope of European law. And the database that they sold had 1 billion finished consultant episodes over a 15-year period from 1998 to 2013, including, for example, all the hospital treatments that Tony Blair and other celebrities had. So that was the second wave. That's what happened in the 1990s and the sequelae when the bad privacy mechanisms that were adopted in the 1990s met the reality of the modern world. Now let's move to the third wave. Next slide is slide 14. And this is what happens when
That's Brown and Trottier.
Because she made a whole bunch of searches around her particular hobbies, and this is her dog here. She made various searches about her dog. And then she made lots of local searches for stuff in Lilburn, Georgia. And it didn't take much detective work to find out that she was this particular user. So AOL fired its chief technology officer and the staff involved. Another flashbulb case there was the Netflix case, because Netflix published so-called anonymized data on 500,000 customers, and they offered a reward of $1 million for a better recommender system. And Arvid Narayanan and Vitaly Shmyatikov showed that many subscribers could be re-identified against public preferences by looking at the internet movie database. And their insight was that preferences tend to have a long tail, that there's a whole lot of people who watch the really popular movies, the 100 most popular movies, but past that, people's preferences are very idiosyncratic and often pretty unique. So after these two large public scandals, there's a University of Colorado law professor, Paul Ohm, wrote a very influential paper called Broken Promises of Privacy. He said, why is it that for almost 30 years now, computer scientists have been saying that we can't anonymize stuff, yet policymakers keep on wanting to believe the claims of bad engineers that anonymization will in fact work? And well, there's a fairly simple principle in play here, which is that it's very difficult to get somebody to understand something if his job depends on not understanding it. And in the various tussles that I had with the medical establishment over the availability of medical records, it's very difficult to get medical professors to understand how easy it is to re-identify records. They come out with immediately all sorts of arguments as to why this is should be very much more difficult than actually it is. And it's about motivated reasoning. Next slide, slide 16. The other interesting thing that happened in the mid-2000s was the development of differential privacy. And it starts off in 2003 when Kobi Nissim and Iridiner considered whether you could just reconstruct a database by linear algebra from using random queries. And their idea was that if the noise is small enough, you don't need too many queries, and you don't need to be too clever about how you do it. You just get enough queries and you do the algebra. And they concluded from that the defender of a statistical database system is going to have to add enough noise. In 2006, Cynthia Dwork, Frank McSherry, Kobi Nissim, and Adam Smith analyzed how much noise was required, and they showed how to analyze privacy systems in order to figure out how much noise you needed to add to prevent disclosure. And their key insight is that no individual's contribution to the results of queries should make too much of a difference, so you calibrate the standard deviation of the noise according to the sensitivity of the data. Next slide, slide number 17, and they come up with a formal definition that a privacy mechanism is epsilon indistinguishable if for all databases X and X prime that differ in a single row, the probability of getting any answer from X is within a factor of 1 plus epsilon of getting it from X prime. In other words, what you're doing is bounding the logarithm of the ratios. And why this turns out to be useful is that if you then add noise with a Laplace distribution, then you get indistinguishability with noisy sums because the maths are such that things compose and you can prove theorems. There's not the time to go into the detail, but look at my book chapter if you want pointers to more detailed explanations. Next slide, slide 18. So differential privacy gives us a dependable measure of privacy when we want to answer specific questions. However, it doesn't give us an anonymous database that will answer any question. And this is a problem that we had with it for, a decade or so. In fact, pretty well since it was invented in 2006. Because some of the authors of the differential privacy paper work for Microsoft, Microsoft was going around saying, we've got this cool new thing called differential privacy, which means that you could make a database as anonymous if you really wanted to. Now, those of us who looked at the maths a bit were deeply skeptical, because differential privacy is a little bit like provable security in cryptography. It gives you fairly strict bounds on the circumstances in which you can get a provable security. It is workable, though, in some very well-defined problems. And the fascinating thing that's happening right now is that it's getting a full test in the 2020 US Census. Now, there are a number of fascinating papers on this by Simpson Garfinkel, who's basically the chief scientist at the US Census Bureau. And I go into this in some detail in my book chapter, but here is a brief summary. In the 2010 census, you ended up with something called the census edited file, which is the data that had been collected from census forms, from people going around knocking on doors, and where they couldn't get a response from a household, they would try and recreate that response using other data available to the government, you know, things like credit references and so on, birth records and voter rolls and so on. And you end up with 44 bits on each resident. And America has a little bit short of 300 million residents, so that's quite a lot of data. And the US Census had, however, published billions and billions of bits in published microdata summaries. So Simpson and his colleagues spent some months writing some software and doing a huge Gaussian elimination on a large cluster, and they showed that they could reconstruct about 38% of the private information from the 2010 census with respect to entirely published information. And the only people who had been swapped, who were protected, were people who had been swapped. So having done this, they persuaded the management of the US Census that in 2020 they should try to protect everybody. And so that's why we're having the first full field trial of differential privacy. And there are all sorts of problems with it. It only works for the short form census questionnaire that all households in the USA answer. It is no good for the more detailed summaries that are the more detailed questionnaires that are given to a subset of households. Even so, there are lots of things that have to be fixed when you add noise to the summaries that you're going to publish. First of all, when you add noise, that means that the totals don't all add up. And if you ended up with state totals of population that didn't add up to national totals, that wouldn't work legally when it comes to allocating the number of congressmen that each state and each district gets. And so they have to turn the thing around and add the noise top down. So at the top level, where they need exact outputs for legal reasons, they have exact outputs. And then as they go down, they have more noise in counties and more still in blocks. And they need special handling for edge cases. This is something that we've come across in previous years as well. What happens if you've got places like colleges and prisons? In colleges, for example, in university, you might have 1,000 people living at the same postcode, most of whom are between age 18 and 21. And so you've got large numbers of birthday collisions, and that has all sorts of interesting effects. And if you were to swap colleges around, that wouldn't work too well because everybody knows how big each of the colleges in Cambridge is. So you have to think through quite carefully how you're going to deal with these edge cases. But the beauty of taking a differential privacy approach is you no longer need to enumerate all the site information that an attacker might use, which is something that they had to think about in the previous. calculations which suggest a value for epsilon of between 4 and 6. And so this is a work in progress, and sometime next year we will have the results in and we'll be able to evaluate how well differential privacy did. But it must be said that differential privacy only works where you've got a very, very tightly defined problem, when you know with great clarity in advance exactly what questions are going to be asked of the data. It doesn't help you with things like medical records, where something can come along that's new, something like a pandemic, and then you need to analyze the data in ways that are suddenly new. Next slide. GDPR. The General Data Protection Regulation 2016/679, to give it its European Union name, arose because Germany and France in particular were unhappy with the UK and Ireland, who had done a deliberately weak implementation of the Data Protection Directive with many loopholes, which were designed in order to make it easy for companies like Google and Facebook to operate in Europe. And in fact, in Ireland, it had been deliberate policy for over 30 years that they do whatever they can to attract American companies to make their headquarters in Europe. Low taxes, no privacy laws, whatever the American companies wanted, they got. So GDPR was the pushback, and it was the most heavily lobbied law ever in the European Parliament, with over 3,000 amendments proposed in the Law Committee. And so that finally went through, and an awful lot of the things that the big tech companies do is now illegal. Behavioral advertising, everybody agrees, is illegal. And all the various privacy regulators kind of say, okay, Mr. Google and Mr. Facebook, when are you going to start obeying the law? And Google and Facebook say, blah, 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 waffle, 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 blah, blah, blah. There's just no enforcement. And so Austria's contribution to this is Max Schrems' wonderful lawsuits, where he sued the Irish regulator behind whom Google and Facebook were hiding, along with many other US firms. So what does the future hold? What's the future direction? Next slide, on page 21, we start to look at the fourth wave. Now, the big changes during the 2010s, as we have moved from using laptops to phones and as everything has become social and everything's gone to the cloud, are that we get location, we get social, and we get machine learning. Now, universal smartphones and social networks both mean more data, while machine learning means better inference. And so how much can you learn from the extra data? Well, in 2013, Yves Alexandre de Montjoie and a couple of colleagues showed that 4 mobile phone sightings are in general enough to identify somebody. And also in 2013, we got the disclosures from Edward Snowden, who told us about CoTraveler. This is an NSA system that automatically tracks mobile phones that travel together. So if a drug dealer carries around his normal mobile phone in one pocket and a burner phone in another pocket, then the two of them become automatically linked after a time. And if you as a journalist travel around Moscow with Ed Snowden, then no doubt you'll be linked to him after a while too. And court cases since then have told us about the enormous amount of work that police forces in Britain, France, the Netherlands and elsewhere get out of co-location analysis. Slide 22. How can you really exploit mobile phone data? There's a fascinating article written by Stuart Thompson and Charlie Warzel, which appeared in December in the New York Times, with the heading 12 million phones, one data set, zero privacy. And Stuart and Charlie bought a data set of 50 billion pings from 12 million phones that had been collected over several months in 2016 to 2017. Over the US, the previous US election and inauguration. And these phone pings were bought openly in the open market. They were collected by mobile phone apps that people had downloaded and installed in their phones, and they'd given consent to these apps to record their location, and there are lots of apps that do that, and they were then just sold in the open market. And Stuart and Charlie showed that they could follow lots of different people. They looked at some of the demonstrations in DC around the inauguration of President Trump, and they found that they could follow both cops and demonstrators home, because once you know somebody's phone, you can figure out how they go home, where they go to work, where they have their breakfast, all sorts of stuff. It's dead easy to identify people. They identified a singer at President Trump's inauguration, and they identified Secret Service officers too in his detail, whom they followed home. They followed visitors to celebrities' mansions, and they followed visitors to vice clubs. And as an example of a commercial use, they followed a Microsoft engineer who traveled from his home in Seattle to Microsoft every day, except for one day when he went to Amazon to interview there. And then the following month, he started commuting to Amazon instead. And he pointed out that if Microsoft had been collecting this data on their engineers, they'd have been able to tell that that engineer had gone to interview at Amazon. Next slide, slide 23. What can you do in terms of better inference? Well, a couple of my former students, Kumar Sharad and George Denizis, showed that you can use a random forest classifier to re-identify records of who phoned whom by comparison with a social network graph. Another example is the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which caused us some embarrassment here, because a Cambridge postdoc from our psychology department figured out that he could tell whether you were straight or gay from four Facebook likes. And a lecturer who is no longer with us extended this to personality traits, ethnicity, and political preferences. He got 200,000 Facebook users to run his app, and he then collected data on all their friends. And this information was duly sold to the Brexit and Trump campaigns. And this was a clear breach of privacy law, election law, and research ethics. And that person is no longer with this university. Next slide, slide 24. Another example of the fourth wave, an example of abuse. Google's AI subsidiary DeepMind persuaded the Royal Free Hospital in London to give them patient records by saying they'd develop an app to diagnose acute kidney injury. The hospital gave them all 1.6 million records of all the patients who had been there in the past 15 years, rather than just those of the 60,000 relevant kidney patients. Now, our information commissioner reprimanded the hospital, but didn't force Google to destroy the data. And the medical director of that hospital got promoted and is now one of the people leading the UK's COVID response. Again, clear abuse and no enforcement. So what can we do about this? You know, if you're a researcher, how do you cope with the issues that arise? Well, we've known in medicine for a long time, slide 25, that the law's boundaries are way too wide. And if you do everything that you can't be jailed or sued for, you'll quickly lose the patient's trust. So what is an ethical research approach to medical practice and medical research in a world of cloud-based health records and genomics? And what's an ethical approach to computer science research for that matter too? So 5 years ago, the Nuffield Bioethics Council in Britain set up a project. Next slide, slide 26. And we produced, there are 12 of us, I was the one IT guy, there were medics, insurance people, philosophers, all sorts of people, and we spent a year hammering out this question, what happens to medical ethics once we have cloud-based health records and pervasive genomics? And where the old rubric of consent or anonymize fails, then what should an ethical researcher do? We come up with four principles, which I'll go through briefly. First, respect for persons, the set of expectations about how data will be used in a data initiative, this is slide 27, should be grounded in the principle of respect for persons. So people have got a profound moral interest in controlling others' access to and disclosure of information relating to them in circumstances they regard as confidential. Next slide, 28. Human rights. The set of expectations about how data will be used in a data initiative should be determined with regard to established human rights. We discussed the IV Finland case from ECHR in an earlier slide. Next slide, slide 29. The set of expectations about how data will be used or reused in a data initiative and the appropriate measures and procedures for ensuring that those expectations are met should be determined with the participation of people with morally relevant interests. This is a long-winded way of saying that you have to consult very widely, not just ask a few friendly medical professors on a research ethics committee. You should tell the public what you're doing, where it's possible, you consult all your patients and let them opt out. If not, you certainly must not hide what you're doing. And finally, slide 30, principle 14, principle for accounting for decisions. A data initiative should be subject to effective systems of governance and accountability that are themselves morally justified. And this includes, we believe, responsible disclosure. Effective measures for communicating expectations and failures of governance, execution and control to people affected and to society more widely. And we see just in the last 2 days, a terrible example of this in Finland, where an organization that organized psychotherapy for some 45,000 patients was affected by ransomware and all their patients' data were stolen. And the chief executive of the company hid this for a considerable period of time while the thieves were demanding a ransom of 450,000 Bitcoin from them. And when the company didn't pay, it started putting people's medical records online and asking them individually for a ransom of 500 euros to take the data down. In a case like that, I certainly hope that the Finnish authorities will take strong legal action against the management of that company. However, ethics has got significant limits as an approach. And a very good example of its limitations is the research that's now being done on COVID by teams such as that led by Ben Goldacre's Open Safely project. What they've decided to do is to respond to the pandemic by running database queries inside the databases of medical records themselves. That is, the service companies who provide cloud-based medical records have made their facilities available for researchers because of the pandemic. And this means that they have got direct access to the medical records of tens of millions of people, and they can see who was sick with what, who had which pre-existing condition. They can see what the mortality is over the past 6 months and how the excess mortality is correlated with age, with sex, with heart disease, with lung disease, all sorts of things like that. So this is enormously valuable results, but it's something for which it was not practical to get consent. And anonymization wasn't relevant because they work directly with live data. So there you need ethical approval. So you need a framework like the Nuffield approach. And in fact, we use the Nuffield approach in our work on cybercrime data because sometimes we're working with data which are the proceeds of crime and it's infeasible to get consent. But ethics committees only go so far and they have a structural weakness in that they are designed to protect the researcher rather than the data subject. And given these poor incentives, you need the law too. And that's why we need better enforcement of GDPR. And we need to accept that this is an area where there are no easy solutions, but simply having laws that are widely ignored isn't the best of all possible worlds. So what can we say? Well, slide 32. This is a saying from my thesis advisor, the late Roger Needham. Privacy is a transient notion. It started when people stopped believing that God could see everything and stopped when governments realized there was a vacancy to be filled. And in the final slide, slide 33, there's my security engineering book. And the talk that I've given you today is written up in some detail in chapter 11. Which is free to download for the rest of this week. So if you're interested in this, then please go and help yourself. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. There's some bad news. You could be heard, but your picture disappeared. Your screen disappeared. The slides were on and your voice was on, but you couldn't be seen. I think people will survive that. We have one question, and we're in a bit of a hurry because we were late. We have a question. Would you mind to answer that, please?
Sure.
The question is, how to protect data in morally changing times?
Ah, that's a hard one. But those of us who've been involved in policy, for example, over government access to cryptographic keys, have been saying for many years that you have to be careful the extent to which you trust the government, because the government might not always be democratic. And, you know, back in the 1990s, when everything was bright and sunny and, the world was run by people like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, people said, how can you be so stupid? You know, you're never going to have bad governments in places like Britain and America. But you know something? When President Trump was inaugurated, all of a sudden, I saw lots of people that I knew from the United States of America popping up on Signal as users, including people from the intelligence community, people who had had top secret clearances for years and years and years. Suddenly they were becoming Signal users. So yes, we kind of morally changing times, and the government that is today your friend can in a few years time become your enemy.
Yeah, like don't trust anybody in the end is what we're all talking about, isn't it? We have no more questions at the moment here from the internet. Thank you very much. Sorry to everybody out there for the technical problems that we have. Sorry to you, Ross, that it's a bit of a disturbance here. Are you still with me? I can't see you.
I'm loud and clear.
But I just can't see you. Okay, well, that's it. Well, thank you very much, and we'll take a big bow and hang on while I moderate. I announce some few things. Okay, the next talk that we're going to have, the nächste Talk, den wir hier haben, ist Corona und sein Schatten, Stalking, häusliche Gewalt und ein Rollback der Geschlechter mit der Sandra Zeger. Corona and its shadow stalking, domestic violence, and a rollback of the sexes. But the talk will start 10 minutes later due to technical problems that we're having here at the moment. Okay, just as a short note, still thank you for everybody. Thank you, Ross Anderson, for coming here.